You're listening to Booth Talk from the After Movie Diner. And on this episode, we are exceptionally honored to talk to cult horror film and B-movie director and DVD producer with his own awesome distribution label, Blue Underground, Bill Lustig. So this is John Cross from the After Movie Diner. How are you doing today?
Okay, how are you doing?
I'm very good, sir. I'm very good. Thank you very much for agreeing to an interview. That's very kind of you. Thank you.
My pleasure.
We had just covered recently the Maniac Cop trilogy. In fact, I was very lucky to speak to Robert Davi briefly the other day about it, and just wanted to get a few words with yourself. So what first got you into directing, and what were your influences?
Well, my influences were really the films of the late 60s, American films and films from Europe, the Sergio Leone films. Some of the American films were like The Wild Bunch, French Connection, Bonnie and Clyde Bullitt. You know, there was all those films from that golden period of the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
And yeah, those were really my influences.
Okay. And so what were your steps into getting into directing? And was it always directing you wanted to do, or?
Yeah, I wanted to make movies. I wanted to direct films. I didn't probably know exactly what it entailed. All I knew was the director had a certain imprint on the films that I liked. And so I was very aware of the director's, you know, what a director was doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was it. I wanted to direct movies.
Great. And yourself and Larry Cohen, James Lickenhouse, Frank Henenlotter and stuff were all making movies in New York before it was all cleaned up. And there was a lot of social commentary in your films like Vigilante, Maniac Cop series and Maniac and so on about that. And you also managed to film on those streets and capture it really well. It seems like filming here now would be sort of nicer and safer, but the movie's less atmospheric and gritty or exciting. What do you feel about New York now it's been cleaned up? And what was it like back then in the 80s and 90s being part of those great New York filmmakers?
Well, I got to tell you, it was I really am nostalgic for the period when Times Square was this movie mecca where you had, you know, a dozen cinemas all on one block showing such a diverse group of films. You had one theater showing Fellini art films next, you know, two doors down from a porno theater.
Yeah.
And I just loved it because it was like a smorgasbord for a film buff. It was, you know, who had an insatiable appetite, you know, to want to watch every movie ever made.
Yeah, right. Do you think there was ever a point where they could have kept the theaters but cleaned up the streets? Or was it just a case of we got to get rid of it all, do you think?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, the driving force behind the cleanup was Disney. Right. When Giuliani did the lease with Disney, I think, for the Amsterdam Theater. And, you know, it sort of blossomed from there. I got to tell you, when I go through Times Square now, I hate it. I absolutely hate it.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I've lived here for 5 years, and if I can avoid it, I do like the plague. I can't bear it, just for the number of people, if nothing else. But, you know, I watch those films from everything from sort of Taxi Driver and then, you know, what Larry Cohen was doing with the blaxploitation movies in the 70s all the way through to, you know, the 80s and 90s movies. And while you wouldn't necessarily want to live there because of the kind of element that was on the street, the films are so much richer, better, more exciting and more interesting for some reason, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, there was an atmosphere, there was a feel. Now, I must tell you also that until about a year and a half ago, I lived in the East Village.
Yeah.
And of all the neighborhoods that cosmetically did not really change very much, the East Village is one of them. So you could still I could still walk down the streets in the East Village. And some of that's changing, I have to admit. You know, there was a Starbucks that opened and all that, but it still reminds me of the streets of my youth over there.
So if you were to make another movie in New York, you'd film it down there?
Yeah, I would probably gravitate towards the East Village, Lower East Side.
Right.
Those places, as I said, you know, cosmetically, they still ring of that period.
Okay,
but,
cool.
You know, sadly, the ma and pa places of my past are disappearing. They're kind of coming, you know, they can't survive in Manhattan anymore. They're moving to Brooklyn.
Yeah. And were you conscious? I mean, obviously, Maniac Cop is made with James Dickenhouse produced it and Larry Cohen wrote it. Were you conscious of sort of a filmmaking group that was happening in the 80s? Or were you all just doing your own thing and happened to converge on Maniac Cop?
I mean, we all kind of knew each other. Jim financed Maniac Cop. He didn't really have a creative participation in the film itself. Or, you know, he kind of agreed to put up the money and then I showed him the movie, you know, 8-9 months later.
Right.
Larry wrote the script. I knew Larry for several years, and we happened to have a fateful lunch where the idea of Maniac Cop was born, and then we started shooting it a month later.
Very cool, very cool. And the Maniac Cop trilogy is a great mix of different genres. There's obviously action and horror and even comedy. Does that come from you or Larry, or is that both of you working together? And what draws you to kind of do cross-genre pieces like that?
Well, it's Larry's script inspired it. And I, of course, love... I'm a big film noir fan.
Yeah.
And so I kind of viewed the Maniac Cop films... is a kind of a film noir where you have this cop who had been wronged and framed and thrown into prison, and now he's taking revenge. You have Bruce Campbell as the unfaithful husband who somehow is believed to be the maniac cop and must do his own detective work in order to vindicate himself. So there's all these noir elements. You know, you have Sherry North, who's a classic, you know, tragic noir figure. Remember her?
Oh, yeah, completely.
The crippled older cop.
She's in love with him, isn't she? Yeah.
In love with him. So you have all of these classic noir characters in a kind of a wacky horror tale.
Yeah. No, I just wondered how much of it was sort of, especially the humor, I guess, in it, how much of that was sort of conscious and how much of that you were sort of putting in because you liked that element as well? Or?
Well, yeah. I mean, I always think anywhere I can inject humor in a picture, I try to do it.
Yeah.
And so I never shy away from humor. I look for it any way I can, whether it's verbal or visual humor. I'm always looking for that because at the end of the day, the Maniac Cop films were intended to be a fun ride. And humor is really, it's the different side of the same coin that is of horror.
Yeah. And was it always, were you the one pushing for sort of each sequel to get more and more action-packed? I mean, you know, the second one and the third one both end with the main character on fire doing more and more ludicrous action things. You know?
I must tell you, I've disowned the third one. Even though I was involved, it was a film that was it became a kind of a committee movie.
Right.
The script that Larry originally wrote wasn't what actually wound up in the film.
Right.
And there were various reasons. I don't know if you were sent the Blu-ray, but we're about to release the Blu-rays of Maniac Cop 2 and 3. Right. And the Maniac Cop 3 Blu-ray contains a behind the scenes that discusses the Cop 3 and why I and Larry disown it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I had a question about that because I'd sort of seen some trivia online, but no real depth. And I hadn't received the Blu-rays yet. But yeah, no, I was interested what happened with that. I mean, I understood that there might have been a conflict with the producer or something, but I didn't know that you and Larry had both disowned it.
It really wasn't a producer conflict. What happened was... we were in pre-production on the movie. Larry had written a script that had a beginning, middle, and end. It was interesting. I don't think it was as good as Maniac Cop 2, but it was an adequate script. And suddenly the financiers, within a couple of weeks of shooting, said to us they couldn't close a deal for Japan, which had been a big territory for Maniac Cop 1 and 2, because the lead was to be a black actor. It was going to be a black detective.
Right.
It wasn't going to be McKinney continuing or Robert Darby continuing. And so to make a long story short, in order to close this important piece of the financing and to get the movie moving forward, I had to agree to bring back Robert Darby. The only problem is we within a couple of weeks of shooting, we had already chosen all the locations and we now had to fit a square peg in a round hole. And the domino effect I didn't realize was going to be as big as it became. Right, and right. So it inevitably caused tension among everybody because we were operating without having a solid script. You know, what script had really started to become obsolete.
Is that when you put in sort of funny scenes like the Paul Gleason, Robert Forster scene to kind of, or was that just always in the script? Or?
That was in the script. The scenes that were added to kind of pad the movie were the romantic scenes between Robert and the doctor.
Right. Okay. Right. I see. Yeah.
They were kind of put in there. Some of those I didn't even shoot. And there was like one kill of throwing a guy over a car or something, which I wasn't involved with.
Right. Okay.
But the problem is that when we went into production and we started to trim the scenes that were specific to the character of the black detective, we wound up going into production with like a 70-page script.
Right.
Needing a 90-minute movie.
Right, exactly.
And what was there in the 70 pages was, you know, we started to see things unravel.
Yeah.
It was a film that I believe was ultimately, what we should have done for Maniac Cop 3 is, in retrospect, we should have stopped pre-production, accepted whatever the losses were of money that had already been spent, and gone in and rewritten the script from beginning, to the end.
Yeah.
And then gone back into pre-production.
Yeah.
We should have suspended. And I think we were all, if we were all honest with ourselves, we were kind of greedy to want to just kind of collect our money and move on to our next projects.
Yeah. Although I suppose by the time you get to a third part, it's maybe the passion for whatever the original idea was is not always going to be there in the same way.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I don't disagree. I think I was feeling a little dispassionate about it.
Yeah.
I really just kind of wanted to move on. And I did feel a little stuck in the mud. But all of that, of course, was entirely different for part two.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about part two as well.
Part two was really the highlight of my life in my career because it was an enormous challenge, but it was also very satisfying.
And so that's your favorite of the trilogy and almost the favorite of your films, it sounds like.
It is. It's actually my favorite film. I was so happy to rescue it from oblivion. It was stuck in a bankruptcy and had been out on budget DVDs looking like shit.
Yeah.
And on, you know, Netflix and, you know, really a transfer that had been done back in like 1990. And so I've gone back and retransferred the movie from its original negative and fully restored it, both the video and the sound. And in fact, we're doing the re-release of the film around the country over the month of November and December.
Oh, excellent. When are the Blu-rays set to come out?
November 19th. The Blu-rays, it's a Blu-ray-DVD combo pack that's coming out on November 19th. For people that are in New York, we're going to be screening Cop 2 at midnight on November 15th and 16th at the Sunshine Cinema on Houston Street in Manhattan.
Yeah, I go there a lot. I'll definitely be there for that then.
Oh, great. Great. Maybe you can help me with the Q&A afterwards.
Sure, that would be fantastic. Yeah, if you'd like someone there to moderate it or whatever, that would be great.
Couldn't hurt.
Yeah, well, I mean, by all means, I can give you my details at the end of this, and
okay,
yeah, no problem at all. I'd be happy. That'd be fantastic. That'd be a dream come true for me. That would be great.
After movie diner after, yeah, that works out great. We could call it the after movie diner Q&A.
Great, well, that'd be fantastic. Well, thanks so much for that. I just wanted to ask. There was one of the questions about part two. Actually, I wasn't able to find all the information, but was there a reason Bruce Campbell didn't continue on in Maniac Cop 2, or was it so that you could, like with Tom Atkins in the first, scare the audience by kind of killing him off early and meaning that anyone could die during the movie? Kind of.
Well, yeah, it was multi-purpose. It was, you know, it was Psycho-esque that, you know, we can shake the picture up.
Yeah.
By killing off somebody you perceive is going to be around by the end of the picture. But it also allowed us to freshen the movies, because you kind of take a character and you kind of wring the character dry of everything you want to know about the character. And then you want to kind of move on to some fresh character with a fresh perspective.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes it fun, because, you know, you kind of bring in new people with new ideas and new new characters, you know. It freshens it up. So, you know, we kind of took Tom as far as we could. We took Bruce and Lorraine as far as we could. And I really thought by the end of Cop 2, we took Robert Dobby as far as we could.
Yeah. No, the main thing that's interesting about the three films is the cast. You know, I mean, also the change in genres, but the cast throughout all three are fantastic. And you've got like some of the bigger names like Tom Atkins, Bruce Campbell, Davi, and Paul Gleason and people, but also your regulars, people you've worked with a lot, Leo Rossi, Robert Forster, Frank, is it Pesci or Pesci?
Pesh.
Pesh, sorry. And
or we call him Pest.
Pest, okay. Well, in Maniac Cop 3, he kind of becomes a pest, doesn't he? He's running around with his camera crew and things. and then obviously Lou Bernacki, who you've worked with. A lot of those guys you've worked with, again, Relentless, they're all in, and some other films.
Well, it's fun, you know, when you become a family. It's kind of fun to, like, you know, have Lou Bernacki come in and, you know, and he's so good.
Yeah.
I love really good character actors. He kind of made that supporting cop role his own.
Yeah, definitely. And you've got also a thing where, like you were saying about, you know, you went as far as you could with each of the characters. The first two, the way they sort of drop characters and pick up new ones, it's almost like a stream of consciousness. There's almost that idea of, instead of trying to stick to some script guideline, well, in 90 minutes, your hero's got to do A, B, and C over the course of three acts. You know, Larry Cohen just says, well, no, Tom Atkins, at this point, he's done what he can do. He dies, then we go off with Bruce, and then Bruce dies at the beginning of the second one, and so on. It's a really interesting way to work.
Well, the fun of genre is that, you know, the audience already knows when they bought their ticket what to expect.
Yeah.
And it's to surprise them. That
Definitely.
Always is the challenge when you're doing genre. And that's always been Larry's gift as a writer, is he is so well versed in genre that he knows how to kind of take it and turn it on its head.
Definitely. Yeah. I love his films and your films as well. Just the way he writes and the way you get stuff on screen is just fantastic. I'm a big, big fan of that. Like I said, New York filmmaking from that period. And so with number two being your favorite, what are some of fondest memories that you have from shooting the film then?
Well, the fondest memories is getting through it, because we were working in such difficult cold. I mean, it was bone chilling cold when we were shooting the New York exteriors on Cop 2.
Yeah.
I can remember looking at a clock on a bank on the first day of shooting, and it was like 3 a.m. We're doing the shot where Lorraine and Claudia Christian exit an apartment building and get into a taxi. And I look over, and it's like 2, 3 a.m, and the temperature is like 22 degrees.
Oh,
and
wow.
My bare fingers are sticking to the metal on the camera.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's...
It was that cold. And because we were seeking New York vistas, we were always shooting in proximity to the rivers.
Right.
The opening title sequence, which was shot in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, that could not have been any colder. Because we were right on the water. We were right against the water.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, it's like, I guess it's like the Army, you know? You hate it while you're there, but when you get through it, you kind of look back fondly of it because you really pushed yourself.
Yeah. And that's, yeah, and that's obviously reflected then in the quality of the film. You know, it's one of the great sequels in terms of like those genre and horror picks. It's one of those great sequels up there with something like Evil Dead 2, of course, which in some people's minds improves on the first one, you know.
Well, that was my other thing is I was determined to the best of my ability, improve on the first film.
Yeah.
That was my goal. I wanted it. I, you know, not only did I want to repeat, but I wanted to repeat better.
Yeah.
Bigger and better.
And I think that's always the best thing about the genre films is they tend to go for that. And they, you know, when they succeed, it's a joy. You know, it's really great. So just a couple more questions about other films, if that's okay.
Sure.
Vigilante is a big favorite of mine. We had a great time covering it on a much earlier episode of the show, I think about a year and a half ago now. Are there any great stories about working on that film?
I involved with that? With that discussion?
No, we didn't. We didn't have you on back then.
Oh, you guys just did it yourselves?
Yeah, I have got sort of in the second and going into the third year of doing the show, reaching out for things like interviews and things like that have become more of a priority now. Rather than back then, we were just doing a kind of review show.
Well, I should tell your audience that, you know, the Nighthawk Cinema in Brooklyn?
Yes, I do. Yeah,
they have a series that called The Deuce.
Yeah.
And as part of their series, they're showing Vigilante hosted by me on April 10th of next year.
Oh, fantastic. Excellent. Yeah, well, I'll be there for that then as well.
I'm not sure if it's going to be at Nighthawk or it's going to be on 42nd Street. I'm not really sure how they do it.
Right.
I think they do it at Nighthawk itself. But in any event, it's going to be April 10th. Vigilante is part of the Deuce series with the Nighthawk Cinema.
Oh, that's great. It's such a good film, and obviously Forster and Williamson are fantastic in it. What was it like, because it was very early in your career, obviously, what was it like working, you know, with these two guys who were so established from sort of the 70s grindhouse movie scene?
Fred Williamson and Robert Forster are today of my dearest friends, particularly Bob. I see him more frequently than Fred.
Yeah.
And during the making of the picture, which was made again in very difficult situations on the bone-chilling streets of New York, it was, these guys never were complainers. They were consummate pros. They contributed enormously to the movie. And I just can't say enough great things about them. You know, they're just two, in my mind, two giants.
Yeah. And when you were putting the films together, were you thinking of them specifically, or were you thinking of people like them from those genre picks of the 70s?
The one thing I recall when I was working on the script for Vigilante is I wrote next to a character that Woody Strode played.
Yeah.
I put in parentheses Woody Strode.
Great.
So I would say the only character in Vigilante where I had a very strong preconception of who it should be, because he just had a certain aura about him, was Woody Strode. Robert Forster, the character that Robert Forster played, was actually cast. We had another actor cast for that role.
Yeah.
Who shall remain nameless. He was very, I've become friendly with him now, but back then we parted ways.
Right.
And Fred, I would say, you know, when somebody suggested Fred, I just jumped on it and I could think of no one else.
Yeah, he's just a fantastic presence on camera.
It just popped in my head, the actor that we wrote the role that Fred Williamson played, who we had in mind when we were doing the script, was Leon Isaac Kennedy.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
That's who we had in mind. But But when Fred's name was mentioned, you know, it was like, yeah, of course, let's get Fred.
Of course, yeah. And again, obviously he had worked with Larry back in the 70s, so there was that connection there as well, I guess.
Yeah, in fact, I met Larry through Fred.
Oh, that's how it worked. I wondered whether you and Larry knew each other and he'd given you Fred, or whether it worked the other way around. Okay, that's interesting.
No, cool. Well, it didn't work the other way around, but it was a situation where we were already shooting the movie and Fred met Larry and I came along, and that's how I met Larry the first time.
Oh, very cool, very cool. And I'm currently watching Relentless at the moment, the film you did in L.A. with Judd Nelson, Leo Rossi again, and Robert Loggia. How did that film come about? What are your memories of directing that out in L.A.?
Well, that film was a very easy film to make. It was all shot in L.A. It didn't involve any extensive action or stunt work. It was mostly a character piece. And it was, you know, Leo is a great guy, Robert Loggia is a great guy, and Judd Nelson is a great guy. So, you know, it was just, you know, we had a good script. The script had been written by Phil Alden Robinson.
Yeah.
But he used the pseudonym because it was before he became famous.
Oh, okay.
So he used a nom de plume, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
And but he wrote the script, and it was a very good script. And, you know, Bob Loggia and Leo were, you know, they got along great. And, you know, it was one of those films that was very easy to make. It was, you know, it was like taking a vacation. It was, I would say, stress-free.
Oh,
as filmmaking goes.
Yeah. It was a joy, actually, having just watched the Maniac Cop trilogy back-to-back, not for the first time, but for the show, and then going on to Relentless and seeing in that opening scene with Leo Rossi in the police station all those familiar faces being back in the film again.
Yeah.
Looking down the cast list and seeing all your regulars pop up. I love directors who have those, that, like you say, family around them of actors. It's always good fun.
It's fun. It's you know, it's a fun thing, you know. They're good. You're not going to... Look, you're not going to keep people around who are bad.
Right, exactly.
You know? So you're working with really good people, and you have some fun.
Well, that's great, man. That's great. I'm really enjoying the film anyway. I can't wait to finish it. And then lastly, just... intrigued, because I also do a second show with a friend of mine. It's kind of a comedy show about 80s and 90s action films, and one of the ones we came across was Jeff Speakman's film The Expert.
Now, oh God.
Yeah, you're...
Oh,
we,
God.
We have one of those things about Jeff Speakman films. I'm not quite sure why. But what can you tell us about that? Because it's saying you're uncredited on IMDb, but...
Yeah, I got to tell you. I mean, I don't know how. Is there a level above asshole that you can call somebody?
Oh, you mean a level beneath asshole?
Beneath,
I guess.
Asshole,
like,
I should
worse
say.
Than asshole.
I'm trying to think of.
Well, there is, but I mean, it's a four-letter word. It's probably offensive to most people.
I would say so.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was just. He really was. You know, it was, you know, I mean, what do you say? The guy has got no talent. Yes, he knows martial arts, but he just is really a guy with no real talent or soul or, you know, a heartbeat. You know, he's just flat.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard to make a movie like that.
And were you involved... Were you meant to be involved for the whole film and left, or were you brought on when something else didn't work out? Or
no, it was a situation where I started the picture, and in some ways it was very similar to Maniac Cop 3. It got to a point where, you know, it was just we. In that case, we were really limited because of the star of the film.
Right.
So things had to be cut. It was things that, you know, we just was difficult.
Yeah, okay.
And so then, I don't know why, but in both cases, Maniac Cop 3 and this, in order to fill out the running time, there was a need to shoot these prolonged romantic scenes with Jeff Speakman and the lead actress. I forget her name now.
Right.
And dark-haired woman.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, man, this is just unbearable. It's unbearable. So, Jeff had a guy who he liked, who was the stunt coordinator. And I said, you know, guys, just finish the movie. You know,
yeah.
I don't have any interest in it. I let this guy who shot about a week take the credit for the film.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want it.
No, I was just interested. I didn't want to bring up anything that was too negative or anything. I was just interested.
It's not painful. It's just, you know, look, if you're going to have positive experiences in the film business, you're certainly going to have negatives.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, I've had many more positive than negative experiences.
Well, that's great. And I saw, because you must have been the one who put Ted Raimi in it then, because doesn't Ted Raimi have a tiny cameo as the photocopier guy?
Yeah. Is he a mafia guy?
No, he's a photocopier guy. He's working on the...
Photocopier guy, right.
Yeah.
I did his scenes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, Ted, yeah.
You know, I had to put him... Again, family.
Of course. Yeah, because obviously you're close with the Raimis there in both the Maniac Cop. And was Sam meant to be in Maniac Cop 2, or was that...
Yes, he was. And we cut his scene because it just kind of distracted from the flow.
Right.
But on the Blu-ray and DVD, the new Blu-ray and DVD, I have put his deleted scene on there as an extra.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I can't wait to get those and see the new Blu-rays then. That's going to be a real treat.
You know, email me your info and I'll get them out to you.
Oh, that would be great, Bill. Thanks so much for that. That would be fantastic. Was it those experiences then that moved you on to Blu-ray and DVD releasing and producing, or was it for you to...
You know what? While I was making movies in the 90s, now, you got to put your time... You got to get back in your time machine, but there was a format called Laserdisc.
Yes.
That was all the craze with film buffs. And I began acquiring movies... And retransferring them, adding extras, and putting them out on Laserdisc. Well, then, towards the end of the 90s, suddenly there was this new format, DVD, which was Laserdisc-like. It was sort of I consider it a relative of Laserdisc.
Yeah.
And I started putting the things on DVD that I had previously put on Laserdisc. And suddenly, the business began to boom. So it really wasn't that my directing career propelled me into becoming a video company owner. It just, it just sort of happened.
Right. Okay.
You know, serendipity rules in this business.
Yeah, definitely. And it was great that you were able to just kind of go with that. I mean, you had 20 successful years as a director, and now. Is it now like 20 years now as a successful releaser and producer of movies? And
I would say 15.
15, okay. And were you with... was I right in thinking you were with Anchor Bay originally before Falling Beyond?
Well, actually, I never worked for Anchor Bay.
Oh, okay.
But what I did is I produced their early DVDs. I produced the Anchor Bay DVDs through 2002.
Right. I was just curious because there was a lot of obviously Raimi and Campbell related stuff that was released through them, and I wondered if that was down to yourself. But
it was,
yeah.
And then the European films and.
Well, that's fantastic, man. That's fantastic. Well, look, thanks ever so much for your time this afternoon. It's been really great.
It's my pleasure. We're also, since you're nationwide, I mean, there are other screenings in other cities before New York. Like, we're showing it at the New Art next Friday, the 8th. It's being shown at the New Art Cinema in Los Angeles. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I've been there once. I went there to see My Name is Bruce when Bruce Campbell was out there with
it. Okay.
But yeah, if you want to send me the list of the release dates and the cities, I'll put them up on the website with the episode, yeah?
That would be great.
Keep in touch if you want me there on the 15th, 16th.
Yeah, the 15th.
Yeah, let me know.
Send me all your details.
I will do, Bill. Thanks ever so much, man. Very kind of you, and I'm a big fan of your work. We'll continue to trumpet it as long as I have the show and the website and everything.
Thanks, John.
All right, man. Well, look, thanks for talking today, and you have a good afternoon.
Same to you, pal. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, so in that interview, you will have heard Bill mention a Q&A that he was doing for Maniac Cop 2 in New York and wondered if I would come down and help with the Q&A. Well, I actually did go down and host one of two evenings that Bill did at the Landmark Sunshine Theater in New York City. So I'm going to present that for you now as well as a bonus extra on this episode.
We want to make sure the audience, if they haven't realized it already, that we know it's ridiculous. So we wanted something that overtly said to the audience, we know it's silly.
This is Bill Lustig talking about the Maniac Cop 2 rap, and I can assure you that the sound does improve, settle down, and there's no more rummaging noises in the next 30 seconds.
So, anyway, yeah, the Maniac Cop rap was something I kind of had this idea. I said to Jay Chataway, I said, you know, it'd be funny. We just have this Maniac Cop rap during the end credits. We don't use like the. We don't just go back to like scored music. We just come up with something ridiculous. And I thought like it was like one of those ideas you throw out, but it kind of like lingers in the air. And next thing you know, he came back with the Maniac Cop rap song.
So, do you know who wrote the lyrics?
There was a guy. Oh, he's in the credits. It wasn't Jay. Jay did the music, but there was another guy who did the lyrics, and he was brilliant. He came up with these great lyrics.
The Uzi Jacuzzi rhyme is great.
What's that?
The Uzi Jacuzzi rhyme is the best.
Oh, yeah, and what was really funny is when I realized he had taken my suggestion seriously, is suddenly, you know, all these rappers started showing up at our, where we were doing the editing, and I'm going, what are all these guys doing here? And then Jay goes, well, you said you wanted a Maniac Cop rap song, so I'm auditioning rap artists. And the guys were terrific. The guys who did the music, you know, who sung it are terrific. Guys, this is John X from After Movie Diner.
Podcast, which is on.
Isn't it perfect? Because this is like the kind of movie you would go out to a diner afterwards.
Yeah.
So, any questions? Any questions from you guys? He starred in a movie I made called Maniac.
In the credits, Maniac Cop 2 is dedicated to Joe Maniac Spinell. And in this answer, Bill is explaining to a lady in the audience who asked who that was, who Joe Spinell is.
And he died shortly before we started making this movie, and he was a dear friend who died way too early. And I just felt the need to dedicate the movie to him because he was so much a part of my life, you know. And any of you guys see the movie Maniac I did?
Yeah.
Yes.
Not the remake with Elijah, my movie. Anyway, so that's why I did that. And sad, you know. It was you know, drinking and drugs. And he died at 52, way too young. Brilliant actor. Yes. Yeah.
Well, I have a question, and my wife has a question, but she's a little bit shy. She
that's okay. Don't be shy.
I know what it is. But my question was basically the apartment in, was that like supposed to be an apartment in the Brooklyn Bridge, as it were, and if so, is it rent control?
Well, it's a good question, you know, because yeah, I guess we'd all look for that. Actually, the intent was, you see, what I liked about doing these Maniac Cop films is I got to make these hybrid movies. Like, I was able to do, like, my favorite movies are like the Universal Monster movies, RKO Film Noir, The French Connection, I could, you know, the Hong Kong movies of the 80s, you know. So by doing the Maniac Cop films, it gave me the opportunity to kind of make this ultimate hybrid. So my only direction to like Robert Davi is, you are Robert Ryan in the RKO film noir. And, you know, and I said to Leo Rossi, you're Bela Lugosi Igor in Son of Frankenstein. But I know you're not going to do a Hungarian accent, so come up with some other accent. And he came up with a kind of a white trash Igor.
Well, with all the hair and everything and living under the bridge.
Yeah, no, it's exactly
bridge,
the way like Bela Lugosi looked. And, yeah. And Son of Frankenstein and Ghost of Frankenstein.
That's great.
He had, you know, he was Igor. So I was able, so it was fun because I could do anything. And it kind of all fit in this wacky universe that we had in these movies. And the fun part is like you have like a guy like Michael Lerner who comes off the, you know, the Coen Brothers movies, who's playing it totally you know, he's giving gravitas to this guilt-ridden, you know, police commissioner. And then, oh, the other thing, I don't know if you guys picked this up. Any of you guys Car 54 fans? Ah, I knew it would fly past you. Hank Garrett was one of the stars of Car 54, and he's the cop who gets thrown across the police station. And, you know, these are things. I love Car 54, but I guess I'm older than most of you guys. Yeah.
All right. I have two questions. One, what jail did you film at?
It was a set. It was a set in Culver City. Oh, you're talking about the exterior or the interior?
The interior.
Interior was a set in Culver City. Because we can't go into a real jail and light people on fire and throw them around.
Yeah, you guys, it looked like you were real meticulous about jackets, being like corrections jackets and stuff.
I don't know how I don't recall being meticulous about it.
Because everything, I was like, wow, I was surprised. Right.
The exterior, though, was Rahway State Prison.
Oh, okay.
So what I wanted to do was set up a real exterior to give it, like, you know, like, this is a real prison.
I thought it was
prison. But then, like, the exterior, when we got closer where the bus blows up, that was, like, in some, like, it was on some alley in downtown L.A., and it's, like, bits and pieces we shot all over the place. And the interior was Culver City.
Okay, and my second question is, are you ever going to do another movie, or are you, like, you called it in?
So, well, it's not a call. You know what it is I, you know... It's kind of pain. You know, when I was in the 90s, movie business changed. You know, when we made movies like Maniac Cop 2, there was nobody to answer to. I got to make whatever movie, you know, our group, our creative group, we got together, we made a movie, and there was no parents watching us. And then suddenly it became weird. It's like it became more prohibitive to make the movies you wanted to make, and they became more committee-oriented. So I just got tired of it, you know? And so now people want to make remakes. I mean, there's a remake being made of Maniac Cop right now with Nick Reffin, who did Drive and Only God Forgives. And that's being done.
I saw the Maniac remake.
Oh, the Elijah Wood one.
Yeah.
What did you think?
Honestly?
Yeah.
I hated it. I loved your film. Didn't like the remake.
All right. Okay. It was different.
Yeah. Going back to the first question, how long did you shoot in New York versus how long you shot in L.A.?
Well, we first started in New York, and we shot in New York for about 2.5 weeks, and then we with our major crew, and then later we came back. Actually, Jim Lemo came. He was coming to visit his parents for Christmas.
Yeah.
I said, "Well, Jim, I need some Times Square establishing shots, and I need a car pass. You know, I need some. You know." So he went out and did some of the car buys and exterior establishing shots. But you know, that's like little pickup shots.
Yeah, but it was mostly night shoots in New York.
Oh yeah, cold.
Yeah,
cold, frigid.
And what was it like filming around sort of 42nd Street in that area back in those times when it was a bit...
Well, we only shot for like one day in Times Square, but I had like a small crew, and we were bouncing around. We did the exterior where Mama Leone's and Phantom of the Opera. We did that. You know, so we shot a few hours there. Then we did the shot where they're dragging the guy out. You know, we like ran around with a van. I did the shot of Davi coming out of the alley and... Well, like, you know, that was, it was no big deal.
No.
I mean, I'm a New Yorker. I know, you know, I'm not like intimidated by the thought, you know, I know how to do it, you know, it was no big deal.
Yeah.
It was no big deal. In fact, I was surprised when we hung the guy on the back of a tow truck. Nobody really gave it a second. Nobody came out outraged.
Just another night.
Yeah, exactly. It was fun. I hate that Mama Leone's. I wanted to find some way to disparage it. The worst restaurant in New York.
Nice.
Yeah.
I just was wondering, you know, when the first scene, you know, when you're the paddy wagon gets, you know, driven into the Hudson.
Yeah, that's from the first movie.
Oh, that's from the first. Okay.
Yeah, we did that because they referred when we weren't originally going to do it because I had this like grandiose idea that everybody who's going to see Maniac Cop 2 has seen the first one. And when I cut the movie together, I realized we really need to see the end of the first one, because they keep referring to the paddy wagon in the river, and he was in the river, and, you know, there's all this stuff, and so, you know, we added it, you know.
And what was the choice to go? Because obviously in that opening stuff, you've got the makeup on Robert Zadar from the first movie. I understand that you and Larry Cohen wanted to change it up for the second one, and do a more, a bigger facial.
We did a more elaborate one for the second one, and because we never really established, to our satisfaction, a good makeup job on the first one, so we were a little more focused on the second one for the makeup.
Because you went for a full face rather than just redesigning the.
Well, you know, the first one was made for about was just made for a little more than $1 million, and this one was made for about 3-4 times that amount. So, we had to make it a little better.
But Zadar didn't like it, right?
Zadar hated it. Oh my God, absolutely hated it. I'll tell you a story about Zadar. We were shooting the police massacre scene, and I needed him for like practically every shot in the scene. And it was about 3 a.m, and each setup, because of all the squibs and everything, the explosions. It took a lot of time. It took a lot of time to do the setups. So I'm taking a nap in one of the trailers, 3 a.m, I'm exhausted. And it's a tiny little trailer with just a little tiny bed and a folding metal cheap stool. And suddenly, it's a knock on my door, and Zadar enters in his full makeup and uniform, and he sits on this little chair, and he's got his head hung. He goes, "I can't take this anymore." He goes, "When they first put it on, it's amusing when they first put it on, but when I eat, the food goes down between the makeup and my skin, and the lights and the smell, it's so disgusting." And I'm looking at him, and suddenly I get the giggles. And I got this big guy there, like, you know, and he's not finding my giggling to be amusing. But I can't stop. I'm looking at him going, "This is so absurd, no one would ever believe it." So he goes, "I want to rip this off." I go, "No, Robin, you can't rip it off. You're in every shot. If you rip it off, we have to wrap shooting." So I go, "Hawaii, think Hawaii. You and your girlfriend, I'll get tickets. When you finish the movie, you and your girlfriend go to Hawaii. Think about Hawaii right now. Focus on Hawaii. Focus on." And I was like, it was like I was trying to hypnotize him away from his predicament. Yes, anybody else? Sure. And you and, yeah. Well, what happened is what was great about Cop 2 for me was it was a culmination of a group of people. We had made like 4 or 5 films back to back, and Spiro Rosados, who I gave him his first shot in the first Maniac Cop, it was like his first major stunt coordinating job was Maniac Cop 1. And he was so outstanding. By the way, you know how I hired Spiro? It's funny. Most guys come in with reels showing their films. Well, he didn't really have any films. So what he showed me were home movies that he had made where he played the theme from Shaft to him running across his mother's rooftop and jumping off of it. And I saw such passion for stunts. So now I hire him, and he was phenomenal. He was the one who doubled Bruce Campbell going into the river on the side. He was just phenomenal. And so we began hanging out together, and we would go see all the Jackie Chan movies. We were going down to L.A.'s Chinatown and going to see all the latest Jackie Chan, Chow Yun-fat films. What was the other guy? Jet Li. I don't know if he was really around then, but there was a few. But they were playing a lot of these, and this is before they became mainstream. This is like, you know, we would see like Rumble in the Bronx like 2 years before it came out in the States. Anyway, and so when we did Cop 2, we were thinking about all the stuff that we had seen in the Hong Kong movies. And we incorporated it into Maniac Cop 2. P.S., Spiro is now the hottest stunt coordinator in the business. He did the last two Fast and Furious films, and he's doing the new one.
Cool.
As well as Captain America. I mean, this guy is like... And all he says to me is, Bill, I just do it the same way we did on the Maniac Cop movies. he says, you know, I said, well, how'd you do this with Vin Diesel? And he'll go, we just did it, you know, we just did it. We didn't do CGI. There's, you know, very little wire work. We just did it practically. And that's why it has a sense of jeopardy when you see the Fast and Furious films. I mean, there's some stuff that's over the top. But when you see some of the you know, the car chase stuff, it looks, you know, it's very impactful because it's real. Yeah. Somebody?
Anybody else?
Oh, you had a question, yes.
Speaking of the police station massacre, I remember reading that scene almost got the movie an NC-17. Was that true? And if so, what did you have to take out?
No, actually, we didn't have to take out a frame of this movie. And same thing with the first Maniac Cop. Funny enough, the only place that we had to cut something was for the UK, for the first Maniac Cop in the shower scene when they slash his face, which was a pivotal story point. We had to cut it in the UK on the first Maniac Cop. Funny enough, the exact same flashback contained in Maniac Cop 2 passed in the UK without cuts. So I can't figure those people out. But no, we didn't have to make any cuts for the MPAA. None whatsoever. Yes, we have to leave.
Oh, no, I have a question.
Oh, okay. I thought you were kicking
off. No, I'm fine. Do you have any advice for, like, aspiring filmmakers?
Do I have any advice? I mean, you know, okay, I can only tell you for myself, I was obsessive about making movies. I quit high school. I worked in editing rooms. I worked as a production assistant. I was tenacious in... And trying to apprentice to learn the craft of making movies. And I'd say if you were in film school, quit. I mean, use film school to network. I think film school is very good for networking, but I think it's not the, you know, nobody's going to hire you because you have a certificate, you know, a diploma from NYU. You know, it's just not going to happen. You know, you just work. Just work as an apprentice. The problem is, the older you get, it's harder to work for free, you know, because then you start having responsibilities. I started working for free when I was like 16 years old. I was working in the film business, and I was able to work for free because you didn't look like, you know, like you were backward if you did it. But if you're like 26 and working for free, it starts to kind of feel weird, you know. I mean, it's hard. It's a tough business, but I love it. You know, it's a great business. I've never done any other job since I'm 21. I haven't had any other job. I've never made a living in any other way except for the film business since I'm 21. So it's been good to me. Yeah.
Other than I always wonder, like, what you have some really great anecdotes when it comes to all this. I was just wondering when it comes to like what was the weirdest or most bizarre thing that happened on set of this movie? Was there anything else that really was that stood out other than the fact, like driving around with like a corpse hanging off the back of a tow truck? Oh. I mean, nobody says anything, but is there anything else crazy like that occurred that was like, oh my gosh, what a wild story this is?
Well, you know, the funny part is I think we were like having the monster and the serial killer walk across the Brooklyn Bridge. You know, it was something like, you know, I wanted to do it, and it was, you know, we were just focused on doing as many of those kinds of things as we could, you know. Nobody got hurt during the movie, despite the danger of the stunts look, you know, the way the stunts look. Nobody got injured. On this film, you know, which, you know, and you know, this, I'm trying to think of something that was, I mean, I'm sure there are, I mean, I'll think of it when I probably leave, but I can't think of it now. Yeah.
Did you get, like, any really crazy write-ups from a critic about this movie that, like, stood out, kind of like what happened with Maniac?
Well, you see, the tragedy of this film was that it never got released in America. And I'm so, I feel right now that I have released it from its ghetto as a budget DVD in a bargain bin at Walmart. The film actually played theatrically all over the world. I even had the Pakistani poster to prove it. But in this country, it went straight to video and to HBO. And so it didn't, so to answer your question, it really didn't get any real critical notice. The Blu-ray we've been sending to critics, and it's gotten some outstanding reviews by the critics. It's like everyone's going, where did this movie come from? You know, we didn't even know it exists.
Everyone should buy it. Everyone should go out and buy it. It's fantastic Blu-ray.
Thank you.
It really is. It's great special features. What? Absolutely fantastic transfer. I was going to ask about the process of getting it from, you know, the shitty version that they had on DVD that was like a VHS copy to what we saw tonight.
Well,
which
I just went back to the original
print.
Camera negative and transferred it in what's called 4K, which is 4,000 lux resolution. And I, you know, that's how we did it. Just go back to the original camera negative.
Yeah.
Oh, one thing though, the Village Voice called it. They just gave it a review this week, and they called it dopey fun.
Well, that's good. There's not enough dopey fun in the world.
Where did you get the retransfer?
Pardon?
Where did you do the 4K transfer?
Photochem in Burbank. Anybody else have any questions?
Have you ever heard about, like, I mean, I wonder how the NYPD feels about this movie.
Oh, it's funny you should mention that. My brother... who actually appears, he's the first guy who gets shot in the precinct, my brother. When the maniac cop comes in the place, that's my younger brother. He appears in all my movies. My brother is actually a prosecutor in Los Angeles. And he was just telling me that he changed offices. He got transferred to another department. And when he was in there, someone said, would you come with us? And they, and they brought him to a lounge area, and in there was a maniac cop poster. The cops love it. They go, the right to remain silent forever. Oh, they love it. they just love it. No, the cops were. I mean, they were. First off, they knew it was a goof. We're not making, you know, Prince of the City or Serpico or something, you know. We're making a movie called Maniac Cop, and they're like the biggest fans of the movie. Any police officers here? No.
It's a little bit critical.
What's that?
It's critical of, like, police excess and stuff.
Well, it's actually kind of like, no, I don't think it's that critical of it.
No,
I think it's actually, you know, saying, well, you know, sometimes you got to do what you got to do. Anybody else have any questions? No?
Is there... Oh, sorry.
One more. Did you ever see Psycho Cop?
I never saw it, but I actually threatened legal action against the company. Yeah.
I bought it at a flea market a couple of years ago.
Yeah. VHS. Yeah, but I know the guy who did it.
It's nothing like... yeah.
No, I know it's not, but it's they had used... they said in it, it was such a stretch, the company that released Maniac Cop on video, which had nothing to do with the production of the movie, it said, from the people who brought you Maniac Cop.
Oh, wow.
But it was only referring to the video company. But it made it sound like it was coming from the people who made the movie Maniac Cop. So I threatened legal action unless they removed that from everything.
Talking about the police, there's the story about filming. Was it in New Jersey late at night around Christmas time?
It was West New York.
The cab scene.
The cab scene. If you guys notice, it's got a lot of residential buildings there, and we were shooting all night long, including up to about it when sunrise, and we were making a lot of noise. But it was great because the police. In West New York, we were paying them, and they were making their Christmas money. So the way they wanted us to keep shooting, so they would do everything to quiet the neighbors. They were like running interference for us because they were making their Christmas money. So we got to really do a lot of things in West New York that we probably would not have gotten away with any other time of year.
Yeah.
Anybody else?
Anyone else?
Is that it? All right. Well, get home safe. Thank you for coming. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Bill. That was fantastic. Thank you.
I'm Steven Seagal. That's right, Steven Seagal. And for the past 40 years, in between barbecuing oxen and roasting boar for my insatiable appetite, I never miss an episode of Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid commentaries. Ain't that right, Johnny?
Hi, I'm Dr. Action.
Hi, and I'm the Kick-Ass Kid.
When I'm not watching action films, I'm usually polishing my gun while looking at a bat.
And when I'm not watching action films, I'm normally outside with a harpoon killing puppies.
But usually you can find us both watching 80s, 90s action films. You could follow us on Twitter, Dr. Action Kick-Ass.
You can find us on our main page, which is dractionkickass.blogspot.com.
You can also find us on iTunes and TalkShoe.
Yes, every week we do a commentary on an 80s and 90s action classic, and where we can, we also provide the film so that you can watch along with it.
This podcast explodes.
Hey, where's that baby mama at? I gotta tase somebody.
Do you like movies? Do you like beards? Do you bathe in raw meat? Do you dance under the fiery sky of Ra, daisies threaded through your man chest vein? Foolish question. Yes, we all do. But do you do it listening to the podcast from the After Movie Diner? If not, then you're missing out, and you may or may not spend eternity in insufferable torment, wedged between Simon Cowell and Piers Morgan in an elevator that smells of death. The After Movie Diner is a website dedicated to movies. New, old, large, small, and of every genre. There are written reviews, interviews with the famous and interesting, and a weekly podcast with comedy, reviews, interviews, a variety of fascinating and flatulent co-hosts, and music to tap your toe to. So why aren't you on board? Get there or miss out on the podcasting sensation of a generation. One that feels like being slightly tongued by an overenthusiastic Cocker Spaniel. Find us on iTunes, Spreaker, Stitcher, TalkShoe, and over at aftermoviediner.com.